welcome to FilmBookCast, the only podcast that was made in such a harsh, cold climate that others have no choice but to shower it with awards and praise.
Wow.
FilmBookCast is the official podcast of FilmBook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who is ready to live deliciously.
Mike DiCriscio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I kind of want that on my tombstone. Just right. Mike DiCriscio, live deliciously.
Now, if you've never listened to FilmBookCast before, essentially we start with some film news and then move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we're consuming lately. However, this week, instead of talking about whatever movies or TV shows or whatever we've been watching, we're going to talk about the Oscars, which just aired last night, which should be a grand old time.
Yeah, I would agree.
Good, I'm glad you agree. After that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the new film from director Robert Eggers and a surprise hit of last year's Sundance, The Witch.
That's what we're doing.
That's what we're doing. Oh, man. You always have the best add-ons to the things I say, Mike.
Yeah, I know, Mike. You don't have to tell me.
All right. Well, I guess we can move on to some film news. Let's do that. Why not?
Oh, man. This is off to a wonderful start.
Oh, man. All right. So film news, that was actually a huge couple weeks of film news. It seemed like every day there was something new coming out, something wild and crazy.
Unheard of.
Unheard of. Unprecedented.
Never before have they announced a cast for a Marvel movie. Speaking of which, the Guardians of the Galaxy 2 cast has been announced.
Oh, man, great segue. Yeah. Yeah, our first story of the day is that Guardians of the Galaxy 2 has officially announced its cast. And it's pretty much everybody you'd expect. Most of the people from Guardians of the Galaxy are coming back. Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Bradley Cooper, Vin Diesel, Michael Rooker. The only major omission is that Benicio del Toro is not coming back. And this is kind of surprising.
Yeah, I'm interested in... Well, I mean, I guess because he got blowed up in the last one, but he's still alive.
He's still alive, yeah.
But I wonder how they're going to tie in more stuff, if they're going to do Infinity Stone things or
what. I feel like they're not. I mean, apparently, according to James Gunn, Thanos is not going to be in the movie.
Oh, okay.
So, that's interesting because it's weird because I think Thanos had a very small role in Guardians of the Galaxy, and it was a role that made you think he's being set up for a future movie, and he technically is because he's going to be the big villain of Avengers: Infinity War. Mm-hmm. But it's weird that he would be introduced in Guardians of the Galaxy and have the characters in Guardians of the Galaxy, many of them have ties to Thanos in certain ways. Gamora is, Thanos' half-daughter, right? And Thanos killed, Drax's family. I was going to say Batista's family. I could not remember Drax's name.
Smooth. Yeah, it's odd that possibly the smallest Marvel film, scale-wise, I mean, it's about the destruction of planets, but, The Guardians of the Galaxy has the most direct link to Thanos out of all the Marvel movies so far.
Yeah.
Which I think is odd.
And he's not going to be in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. I mean, right. I think I feel like he will appear again before Infinity War, at some point. Probably.
I
would guess in Thor 3 if he's not going to be in Guardians 2.
Yeah. Probably
just,
that one.
Just because Civil War has you can't fit any more characters in there, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just can't work.
Well, so far, and also because it's got to be the space movies that touch on Thanos.
Yeah,
because he hasn't made any move towards Earth other than all the Infinity Stones being here.
Right. Yeah, basically, and he doesn't even have any Infinity Stones yet.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. But I'm also down for just Space Pirates Guardians of the Galaxy version. That would be amazing.
Yeah, free from the stuff, the outer Marvel universe. I liked Guardians of the Galaxy a lot, but it is, kind of confined to what they could do in that universe.
Right.
Because they had to tie in with Thanos and stuff and, the Infinity Stones. And I feel like this is just going to be, kind of pure, unfiltered James Gunn.
I really hope so.
And I'm very excited for it. And anyway, there are some additions to the cast. And the most exciting addition to the cast is that Kurt Russell has been cast as Peter Quill's father. That's amazing.
That's the greatest.
Awesome casting. And Marvel's had just a really good run of awesome casting choices for their past few movies. Robert Redford was cast in Captain America: Winter Soldier. Michael Douglas was cast in Ant-Man. They keep getting these really cool established actors. Yeah. Like acting legends of, like, you know, older actors to play these characters, and it's awesome. Like, it's
oh yeah, it's really so cool. Great. Yeah, that's my favorite part about like we got to hear Robert Redford say "Hail Hydra." Like, like we right? get these people that are, like you said, acting legends to be in, like, these silly comic book movies.
Right,
like, that's great.
Yeah, and they do a great job in them too. Like, I thought, like.
Yeah,
like, as you'd expect, but yeah, it's awesome.
I really hope that Kurt Russell's mustache was also cast. If not, it's going to have a beautiful independent career.
Just keeps the mustache that he had from Hateful Eight for the rest of his career. Yeah. Is that the plan?
Yes,
I like it. And yeah, Kurt Russell's an amazing actor and somebody who has had an awesome year. I think we talked about this in the last podcast where he was in both Hateful Eight and Bone Tomahawk and Furious
right.
7.
Right, like. So like, he should hang it up now. He can't get it.
Like that's a phenomenal 2015 right there. And
it
so,
is.
You know, I'm excited for him to ride this momentum into Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and hopefully some other cool stuff as well. Mm-hmm. But it's just a really exciting prospect to have him as Chris Pratt's father. Like,
yeah.
I feel like he's going to play that very well. Yeah. Also cast in the movie are Elizabeth Debicki, who was very good in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Last year, which we reviewed.
Right.
And you can find that on filmbook.com.
Ooh, nice plug.
Also, Chris Sullivan from The Nick, Tommy Flanagan from Sons of Anarchy, and comedian Steve Agee. It's going to be in this movie.
I mean, sure, why not?
I'm sure that's probably a pretty small part, like a cameo role. Guardians had a few cameo roles, like Nathan Fillion had like a very small role as one of the aliens.
Right. John C. Reilly.
Oh, that's less of a cameo, more just like a really small supporting role.
Right, well, I mean, I could see Steve Agee being in that type of...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, small time.
Yeah, being in, like, the Nova Corps or something.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, it's the Guardians of the Galaxy 2 cast. You know, it's exciting. You know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is poised to be really great.
Yeah. And I think there's one thing we've proven time and time again. We will always talk about a Marvel story, so...
Yeah, well, speaking of which, our next story is tenuously related to the Marvel Universe in that... has other comic books in it. Last episode we reviewed a movie called Deadpool.
We did.
And that is a movie based on a Marvel comic.
It is.
And that movie was rated R.
It was.
Once again, just brilliant contributions.
Just, I don't know what you'd do with that movie, Mike.
Deadpool was rated R movie and it turned into this massive success. Like, it became this huge blockbuster hit. It got the highest grossing R-rated opening of all time. I'm pretty sure it is now the highest grossing R-rated movie of all time.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it passed Passion of the Christ, which is amazing.
I think Passion of the Christ passed. I think Matrix Reloaded was the one I think I had to beat.
Oh, okay.
And I'm pretty sure that's what it beat. So it's crazy, and that's crazy stuff. And so... You know, people, like, other studios have been looking at Deadpool as a model for success and thinking, like, how do we model our movies out of this? And
right.
It seems like the answer is we should make this movie rated R.
Yeah.
So there are two movies. So Fox, which made Deadpool, is reportedly eyeing an R rating for Wolverine 3.
Okay, which I understand. I get that one.
That one I kind of understand, if only because, like, people have been asking for an R-rated Wolverine movie for a very long time. If only just so Wolverine can, like...
Cut people in half.
Like, show some blood in those the Wolverine movies. And that would be interesting. I can't really think of any situation where a PG-13 franchise jumped into an R-rating.
Oh, no.
Like, for later movies.
Not that I would ever... be able to figure out. Yeah.
it's odd, and I think, like, Deadpool would technically be in the X-Men universe, so I guess that was an example, but it's also the first of a Deadpool franchise, so
right.
I feel like it's sort of on its own. This would be like a direct, like, there's been two previous Wolverine movies, and
right.
Wolverine's also a major character in the X-Men movies, so this would be it'd be odd, I think. But
This is arguably like the seventh Wolverine movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, all the first three X-Men movies are basically like Wolverine and his friends.
Right. Yeah.
This isn't unprecedented. Fox did release, when The Wolverine came out on Blu-ray, they released an unrated cut, which was,
right.
I didn't see the unrated cut, I only saw the theatrical, but supposedly the unrated cut is a lot more violent, a lot more gruesome, and I've heard it's really good, like, it gets really intense.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be interesting. I think that situation with an R-rating could work. The other thing is that Batman v Superman, which is coming out in less than a month,
right.
At this point, is going to be getting an R-rated Blu-ray of the movie. And that I don't understand.
Yeah, what? That doesn't... I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, that's... It's very weird. Like, I think it speaks to, like, a fundamental misunderstanding of the Superman character. That he can exist in, like, an R-rated universe.
Right. That's, you know? I didn't even think of that. That's a good point.
Like, Batman, maybe. But even then, like...
I could see Batman. I haven't read any Batman comics that I don't know, but I could see for cursing, I guess. Like, I don't know. But, like, it doesn't fit the Superman character at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. And, you know, the thing is, like, what's making me wary about these, like, superhero, like, these R-rated superhero movies is that, you know, superheroes are, like, primarily for kids, you know?
Right.
And,
that's
like,
a good point.
And it's something that has, like, grown up and, like, the genre has matured a lot, but like it's right. Still ultimately like I feel like, you know, you like, why would you take Batman away from an 8-year-old kid?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Deadpool never was or never will be for children, so like that's fine. But Batman and Superman are. So like, I don't know.
It's weird. And you know, it's very odd because the movie is coming out in like less than a month. And so they announced this like just a week or two ago. Yeah. And so the movie that's coming out in theaters is going to be PG-13, and then the DVD is going to be R-rated. The Blu-ray is going to be R-rated. And so, A, it makes it seem like this movie that we're getting in theaters is going to be a watered-down version of whatever is on the
not the version they wanted.
Yeah, I don't know why they would announce this before the movie comes out in theaters.
Yeah. And it also seems like a blatant cash in on the R-rated superhero things.
Yeah, I think so too. But supposedly the R rating is mostly for violence. I guess they had to like tone down certain scenes or whatever.
Yeah, I can see that too. I guess.
Which you know, who knows? I mean, I do. I gotta say, I am kind of excited for Batman vs Superman. I did not like Man of Steel.
Right.
But I am a fan of Zack Snyder, and I think part of my problem with Man of Steel is that you know, that movie is not really Zack Snyder esque. It's like.
Right,
Snyder,
it's almost in black and white, so...
And that's it. that movie's kind of like Snyder, like, kind of filtered through Christopher Nolan and David Goyer. I would say mostly Goyer. And I really dislike David Goyer. you know, this movie is not has no involvement with Goyer. I think Nolan's still on as a producer, but, like, he's not involved with it. He wasn't really that involved with Man of Steel anyway. Mm-hmm. And so this feels like more, like, unfiltered Snyder, like, something that, like... Like this, like the movie that the director of Sucker Punch should have made, you know, back when Man of Steel came out.
Right.
And you know, a lot of people hate Sucker Punch. A lot of people hate Zack Snyder, like in general. And, you know, I get it, but like I also enjoy a lot of his stuff. This seems like it's more up my alley than Man of Steel is.
It'll be interesting to see. I think the film may live or die on how well it handles the, you know, startup of the Justice League franchise.
Right.
Because it seems like they're like, we're going to do 4 movies, just put it all in one. We're going to have, we're going to get Wonder Woman, we're going to put, Aquaman's going to be a thing probably. Sure, put Doomsday in, why not? Lex Luthor's going to be there. Like, they're just going to do everything. And if it doesn't handle all that well, I don't think this movie will be a success.
I mean, I think it'll make money.
Well, that's true, but I mean...
If it's a disappointment, it's going to, like, really wreck a lot of DC's plans.
That's what I mean,
for these movies,
yeah.
Because, I mean, there was rumors that, like, DC might not be happy with Batman vs. Superman, and, like, the reason... Like, the Justice League Part 1 is scheduled to come out next year, and they hadn't, like, started anything on it, you know?
Yeah.
They hadn't started making the movie yet, but Zack Snyder is attached to do Justice League Part 1. And they recently announced that production on that movie is going to start in April. So shortly after Batman vs. Superman comes out. So, I mean, it's happening. It's going to be happening.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens.
I don't know if it'll make that release date of 2017. But, you know, they can try. They can dream.
That's exactly.
But, yeah. Anyway, speaking of projects... that are long delayed.
Sure, count it.
Well,
let's check with the judges. Let's check. Yeah, okay, we can accept that.
Pacific Rim 2 is a movie that.
Oh yeah,
Pacific Rim 2 is a movie that you know, we've talked about in the past that we'd really like to happen. We really like to see happen.
Right. We lamented it's shelving.
Right. Yeah, we were going to put it on the. What are we? What do we call it when we, it was like the 10 years in development club or something, like,
oh man, I forgot about that. Yeah.
And it has not been in development for 10 years, but we were like, when it be, when it is 10 years from now and it still hasn't been made, we'll put it on there.
Right.
And so it could still happen if like this falls through, but, one of the things that we really wanted from Pacific Rim 2, you know, we wanted to see more Guillermo del Toro. I think that was basically our bottom line.
Right.
And so this is like, the news I'm about to say is kind of like a monkey's paw, where like you get what you want, but not in the way that you, that you wanted it. Right. So yep. Pacific Rim 2, it looks like is actually happening now.
Yeah.
After all those delays and, you know, script rewrites and stuff.
Right.
But Guillermo del Toro is not going to be directing the movie.
Boo.
Yeah, it's like that that episode of The Simpsons where...
No way, Mike. You're going to make a Simpsons reference?
It's like that episode of The Simpsons where Homer walks into the like the evil apothecary shop, and the guy's like, it's like, the doll carries a terrible curse. That's bad. It's like, but it comes with a free Froggurt. That's good. The Froggurt is also cursed. That's bad. But you get your choice of toppings. That's good. It's kind of how I felt like reading this Pacific Rim 2 news.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like Pacific Rim 2 is happening. That's good. But Guillermo del Toro is not making it. Oh, that's bad.
Yeah.
But Stephen S. DeKnight is directing it. And I'm like, that's all right.
That's okay. Yeah.
But Guillermo del Toro's script is not being used. That's bad.
That's the... I didn't even know that. That's the worst.
But John Spates is writing the movie. That could be good. So, you know. Do you want me to just do this entire episode as that...
That's the whole exchange thing now. Yeah, I'll just be over here, and you just do your Simpsons thing.
Alejandro Iñárritu won Best Director. That's bad. But Spotlight won Best Picture. That's good. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Anyway, Stephen S. DeKnight is directing Pacific Rim 2. And Stephen S. DeKnight, for those unfamiliar, he used to work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. He created the TV show Spartacus, which is one stars. And he was the showrunner of season one of Daredevil, the Marvel Netflix series. And he stepped down after season one of Daredevil to pursue other projects. And now we finally have an idea of what those other projects are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exciting. I want... more giant robots fighting giant monsters, so, like, it's going to get that.
Yeah.
Presumably.
Theoretically.
But, like we said, the whole point is, like, Guillermo del Toro doing his thing.
Yeah, I mean, and Stephen S. DeKnight, I like a lot of his stuff. I've mentioned this so many times in this podcast, I thought Daredevil was just fine. But,
yeah.
But, you know, I've heard Spartacus is great. I know a lot of people who really like Spartacus. And,
yeah, I've never seen it, but, like, same thing for you, what you've said.
Yeah, and also Buffy and Angel. Like, he was a writer on those shows and directed a lot of episodes of all those various shows. So that's cool. This would be his first feature film as a director, which is kind of like, it's a big one.
That's a big jump.
It is a big jump from, you know, like tiny Netflix Daredevil show to
right. Although that arguably was a huge undertaking. It's a Marvel
Marvel TV show, but comparatively speaking, like that's a show
right.
Like based around like street fights and all this stuff, and this is like a big CGI bombastic craziness.
Right, that's true. What if it's not though? What if it's about a blind Jaeger pilot who fights small kaiju,
like human sized kaiju
in the alleys of Hell's Kitchen?
I like it. So you just want Daredevil, but with like a tiny monster.
Yes. And the mocap will be done by Vincent D'Onofrio.
All right. Well, that's one idea. But
you guys call me. It'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean, part of the appeal for Pacific Rim 2 is that Pacific Rim was such like. It was such a creation of like Guillermo del Toro's like psyche. I feel like,
yeah,
like it was something that feels like only he really could have made. And like, it's not something that's like, this is definitively Guillermo del Toro. Like, I feel like there is other stuff that is more him, but like,
right,
just the, like all of his, it seems like all of his like film influences were just like poured into Pacific Rim. Yeah, I mean, it's what, like, Guillermo del Toro, like, it, like, Pacific Rim is just, like, such a amalgamation of, like, everything Guillermo del Toro loves.
Right.
You know, and it feels like, you know, having somebody else kind of take that up, like, I don't know, man.
And not even have a script that he was part of.
I mean, to be, like, del Toro is staying on as a producer.
Okay. All right.
And he seems very, like, happy with the news, or he was tweeting about it a lot as the news broke. He was tweeting, his big tweet was, "Dream of Kaiju is a Mecca."
oh my God.
If you're not following Guillermo del Toro on Twitter, he has a very fun Twitter account.
Pacific Rim seems like something, it seemed like something that, like, 14-year-old Guillermo del Toro wanted to happen, and it finally happened for him.
Right.
And it was amazing and beautiful, and, at least he's involved in some capacity for the second one.
Yeah, I mean, like, Pacific Rim 2 is, like, I think what's kind of upsetting to me is that, like, Guillermo del Toro, like, announces so many different projects that will never happen, like, that never do. And Pacific Rim 2, even though it was, like, long delayed, it was something that was, like, it was always, like, as if it was, like, a promise, like, if this was being made, you know, it's a new Guillermo del Toro movie. Like, that's kind of, like, the thing. You know, because as of this moment right now, there's no new Guillermo del Toro movie, like, on the docket. Like, there's nothing officially being made.
Yeah, that's pretty sad. I hope this doesn't happen for Hellboy 3.
I mean,
imagine that? That'd be tragic.
That would be. I don't think Hellboy 3 will ever happen, but...
No, I know.
But you never know. And that's really a problem with the people. Like, with everyone else in the world.
Correct, Mike.
Like, why does nobody want a Hellboy 3? Well, no.
Well, the fans want Hellboy 3.
Fans want Hellboy 3, but why aren't there more fans of Hellboy is the question.
I think you're right.
That's the reason. Why was Hellboy 2 a box office disappointment? America.
We'll never know.
all right, but that's, I guess that wraps up film news today.
Sure.
So let's move on to our discussions. And again, we are not discussing media things today. We are just going to be talking about the Oscars. Yeah, so the Oscars were last night, the 88th Annual Academy Awards. And so we both watched them. We both watched them, and I was live tweeting throughout the whole thing and retweeting a lot of stuff. And I know, and so you don't usually watch the Oscars, Mike?
I do. The last couple of years, I just haven't. And it was like, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of lost interest in it for the last 4 or 5 years. So I don't know. But I figured this was the one that if I'm going to watch one, it's going to be Chris Rock skewering Hollywood. So
yeah, I was very excited about Chris Rock being host, and I watch the Oscars every year.
Oh, excuse me.
Well, I do. It's kind of like,
I know.
And you know, I don't really like care that much about like who wins or who loses and stuff. I just kind of like to enjoy the show. And you know, the idea behind the Oscars is that they are a celebration of movies, and so that's intriguing to me, and that's always good. And you know, a lot of times the Oscars are lousy, a lot of times, sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're...
Yeah.
Sometimes they make a fun show, and sometimes they have a lot of really good stuff. And I thought this year was a really good year for the Oscars all around.
I would agree.
Yeah, it had, like, a really great ceremony. I thought the... all the comedy bits. Chris Rock was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
On the show. And, you know, he really, like... really addressed the diversity controversy in like a big way. Like he went head on.
That was the whole show.
Yeah.
Like, in the best way.
You know, and so that was phenomenal. And, you know, there was just other highlights like Louis C.K. introducing Best Documentary Short.
He's got to host next year now.
Yeah, he was phenomenal. And like, that's part of it. Like this, like I was saying, the Oscars are a celebration of film. Like this was like he really like paid tribute to these like people who make these documentary shorts. Like he really like, swung for them, and that was like really, it was really great, and it was really funny. Like his line was like, you know, the rest of you guys, like, you know, this award has the potential to change a life,
right?
Best documentary short Oscar, because it's like the rest of you, like, yeah, if you win an Oscar, like, great, but you're going home to like your mansion,
right?
This Oscar's going back home to a Honda Civic,
like, right? Yeah, exactly,
like that. So that was awesome, and a lot of other stuff. I mean, Pete Docter's speech for Inside Out, I thought was really good. You know, and he's a guy who I always really like to see, just because I think he won for Up as well and gave a very similar speech where it's just like, follow your dreams, like be a dreamer, stuff kind of like that. Also, the In Memoriam section was very good. I thought Dave Grohl did a very good performance of Blackbird, even though it was missing Abe Vigoda from the...
I don't get it.
Like, that seems like a really big oversight. Also, Rowdy Roddy Piper was not included in the In Memoriam.
Yeah. But, yeah. It was pretty odd. I thought the choice of the Zoolander cameo from Bowie was a bold choice. I appreciated it, but
yeah.
It seemed weird.
A little odd. A little odd.
Yeah.
But I was kind of surprised they didn't end with Bowie. I thought he was going to be the one that they ended on. But I was like, I was happy with Nimoy as well as like the final
right
person in the memoriam. Was there anything that took you by surprise, Mike?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head,
really?
But I'm sure it'll come to me.
I mean, I thought the biggest surprise of the night was that Sylvester Stallone lost the best
supporting actor. Awards wise, I was thinking of like the show part.
I mean, okay. But are there awards that surprised you?
Just Mad Max winning almost everything, but then not winning the good stuff.
Whoa, come on.
All right, let me rephrase
the good
that.
Stuff, man. What are you?
Well, it almost swept the technical categories.
Yeah, pretty much. I think if it, I think it, just, only... it lost on visual effects, right?
Cinematography, I think
it lost cinematography also.
Yeah, but I thought for a while, like I really thought George Miller was going to win Best Director once it started winning all the awards, and I don't know.
Yeah, that kind of thing, like that happens a lot.
It does.
Like when Gravity was nominated for a bunch of stuff, that swept the technical stuff too. Mm-hmm. And actually, Cuarón also won director, but it lost Best Picture.
Right.
And it was the same thing the year before that. Life of Pi also won a bunch of tech awards, and Ang Lee won Best Director, but it did not win Best Picture. So actually, right. There's precedent for George Miller should have won. But
exactly.
But Alejandro González Iñárritu won Best Director for the second year in a row.
Which is huge.
Second year in a row. He's the third person in Oscar history to do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
It's pretty wild. The other two are John Ford and Joseph Mankiewicz. But, it's pretty wild. Pretty wild.
I kind of saw that. I mean, I don't know. I feel so conflicted in my heart, Mike.
Well, I know you liked The Revenant.
I'm one of like the seven people on the internet who enjoyed The Revenant and thought it actually deserved awards.
That garbage pile of a movie.
Yeah, see? but also, fucking Mad Max should have won. Like,
Mad Max deserved everything. Like, I was so happy that it won all those Oscars. Like, six Oscars, insane.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And so that was awesome. And just seeing the people from Mad Max coming out to accept the awards was great, because they looked like they were extras on Mad Max. Like,
yeah, and they were all the way in the back. It was awesome. It was so cool.
Yeah, did you see the... there's actually this really funny bit. Not a bit, but like... there's a part where I think Mad Max won for costume design.
Right.
And the woman who won the Oscars was like walking up, and she had to walk down the whole thing. And you could see Alejandro González Iñárritu glaring at her and like folding his arms.
Yeah, well, there's the video, it's a Vine or something, her walking down the aisle, and everyone, all the men sitting on the aisle seats of each row aren't clapping while everyone else is clapping around them.
Yeah, it's really weird. But like,
it's bizarre.
But like, Iñárritu was like sitting right there, and just kind of, that's the one that like stuck out to me. It was, it's like, he's really going to be that like mad about losing costume design?
Maybe because she's wearing the leather jacket with the War Boy symbol on it.
which was awesome.
Which was so badass. Yeah. so that was really cool. I'm glad they gave Mad Max the recognition that it deserves.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of awards.
Yeah, and I wish George Miller would have won Best Director, but, in the end of the day, Mad Max is better than The Revenant, so...
I think we all know that,
like,
Mike.
Right, but, like, it's gonna be the more... I can't speak to what is going to be more remembered in, like, 10 years' time, but, like... I feel like Mad Max has a pretty good shot.
Yeah, in terms of influencing a genre, probably. Yeah.
And in terms of just like rewatchability and everything, like Mad Max, like, people are going to be talking about Mad Max forever. Anyway, like award surprises, the one that like Stallone lost Best Supporting Actor, which was nuts.
Yeah, yeah, it's fucking Mark Rylance.
Well, I saw a lot of people giving hate to Mark Rylance, and I think he's phenomenal in Bridge of Spies. I think he's like really good. I was rooting for Stallone. Like I was shocked that Stallone lost that Oscar. It seemed like he had it in the bag,
right?
If he had to lose it to anybody, I'm happy it was to Mark Rylance. Like that's like he absolutely deserved it.
Yeah, I mean he wasn't bad. I just didn't enjoy that movie very much, I guess.
You gave it a pretty good review when we talked.
I did, but upon thinking of it later, I don't know. Nice. I just didn't want him to win that, I guess.
and people.
Yeah.
People with your British spies hate. I don't get it. You know, you should jump on the Revenant hating bandwagon with me. That's where to be. Also a huge surprise, Ex Machina won Best Visual Effects.
Yeah, well, I mean, they made a robot, so.
Well, that's huge. Like, Ex Machina.
Yeah. That's great.
Like, Ex Machina beat, like, Mad Max and Star Wars, like, movies that had, like, you know, huge budgets for visual effects and, like, really had great visual effects, but, like, Ex Machina had, like, a 50th of their budget and
right.
was able to make something as cool as the Ava robot in Ex Machina and, like, all the stuff in that movie. It's really kind of remarkable, and, like, that was even more shocking to me than Stallone losing. Like,
it's pretty great. And I'm glad the Academy gave them that, because the whole movie hinged on whether or not Ava is believable as like a thing, and she was, which is crazy, like you said, for a movie with such a small budget compared to everything else.
So that was awesome. I was super excited to see Ex Machina win visual effects, and Alicia Vikander also won last night for The Danish Girl.
They say
The Danish Girl, but, like, really, Ex Machina was the good movie that she was in, so.
Correct.
You know, I also will say I never get tired of jokes about the Danish girl eating Danishes.
Oh, my God. That was hilarious. I forgot about that.
Because, like, that's something that, like, a lot, like, I've seen people make that joke before, but, like, it's something that I laugh at every time, and so. Like, just having Tracy Morgan, like, in a dress, like no,
Danish.
I'm the Danish girl! And he eats a Danish. Like, this Danish is good, girl! Hilarious.
Yes.
Also, Leslie Jones was in that bit as well, doing, like, the Revenant thing as
the bear.
Which was really, like, it was funny, but also it was, like, the exact same bit that she said she would do. Like, she mentioned it on SNL. Like,
really?
Like, as a comedy bit, she, like, did that whole thing. like 2 weeks ago. Which was pretty good. Stuff. This was, like, totally shocking and also very funny to me. So the Best Original Song category, there were five nominees. They played three of them. They did, like, three performances. They cut out two. Like, usually they perform all of them. They cut out two.
Right.
I guess the boring two, or the ones that they knew weren't going to win.
Yep.
And so Sam Smith, The Weeknd, and Lady Gaga all performed their songs. And Lady Gaga's performance was, I thought, fantastic. Like,
oh my God,
she was great. And, you know, it was really, like, powerful, and it had, like, a really intense message. And she, you know, it was her and, like, surrounded by, like, victims of sexual abuse. And, like, they got Joe Biden to introduce the performance.
Oh, yeah. That was the fucking coolest thing ever.
Yeah. And it was a performance that, like, knocked everybody away. It was, like, awesome. And then, like, a few minutes later, they hand out the award, and Sam Smith wins.
Yeah, the fucking worst Bond song ever of all time. And then the next award, they, like, the whole time the orchestra had been playing movie theme songs, and then, like, the next award or two later, they play Goldfinger, which is, like, an infinitely better Bond theme.
Yeah.
Just bothered me a lot that song won.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying this as somebody who kind of likes that song. Like, that makes no sense to me that won the Oscar. I've seen people say, like, before, like, they should really, like, save the Best Original Song voting until the night of the ceremony, after all the performances have been tallied.
Right.
After all the performances are done. Because, like, at least that would be, like, you can base it on, like, who had the best performance. Like, Lady Gaga's performance was fantastic. Like, And, like, they really, like, set it up. It seemed like they were setting it up for her to win. Like, just, like, they got Joe Biden introduced it and everything. Like,
yeah, I agree. That was the biggest upset, I think.
I mean,
even worse than Mark Rylance.
I would say Mark Rylance is a pretty big upset. I think he's very well deserving of it. And, you know, best actor, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, time.
Best actress, Brie Larson, which was cool. DiCaprio, I mean, again, DiCaprio, I think, is good in The Revenant, but it's not like. I could name, like, five other DiCaprio movies off the top of my head that I think he's way better in.
Yeah, that's probably true.
You know, and so, as much as I like him, I don't think he was the best in the category. I think of those movies, I think Fassbender probably should have taken it for Steve Jobs.
Okay, yeah, I never saw, I didn't see that, but I could believe it.
Okay, I didn't see Trumbo or the Danish Girl, to be fair, so I'm actually only talking about DiCaprio, Damon, and Fassbender.
But I saw a lot of people saying that the clip they showed of Trumbo was the best scene in Trumbo.
Really? Because that looked terrible.
I think Mike Ryan was the one who, somebody, or a couple other people tweeted it also.
That's insane. That's,
yeah.
Because it looked bad. Like, I,
uh-huh.
Yeah. But, and also, like, yeah, I skipped the Danish Girl, because I, like, I know at this point I'm not going to like it. Like, I'll give it a chance if, like, I happen to come across it, but, like, I'm not a fan of Tom Hooper, and I don't like Eddie Redmayne either, so.
Unless he gives the performance he gave in Jupiter Ascending.
Unless he gives the Jupiter Ascending performance, in which case I'll probably love it. But, yeah, and anyway, the big winner, Spotlight, won Best Picture. Which,
yeah, out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean,
Spotlight. I mean, not really, but.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, Spotlight was an early favorite to win Best Picture, like, as voting was starting. But, you know, it seemed like its momentum had kind of slowed down a lot.
Yeah.
And it seemed like The Revenant was pretty much closing in on that award.
Yeah,
I'm super happy it didn't.
As was most of the internet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, The Revenant has its defenders. Like, people do like the movie.
It's yeah, just, hi. You know. Hello.
Yeah, like you. but, I mean, man, I've soured on that movie a lot, too. Because I basically came at that, like, yeah, it was fine. Like, it was whatever, but I've kind of soured on it, too. And, like, I recognize a lot of elements in it that are good. Like, I think DiCaprio's fine. Tom Hardy's very good. The cinematography is great, like, amazing. And Lubezki won cinematography again.
Right.
Which is the third year in a row that he's won.
Wow.
Yeah, because he won for Gravity, and then he won for Birdman. And now he's won for The Revenant, which makes him, I think, the only the only person who's ever won that award 3 times in a row. I think he was the only person who ever won it 2 times in a row.
And that's crazy.
And now he's the only person who's won it 3 times.
I really thought Sicario, as great as The Revenant's cinematography was, Sicario, like, blew me away with how beautifully shot that
Sicario
was.
Sicario is a fantastically shot movie, and that movie is shot by Roger Deakins, who has been nominated for an Oscar 13 times now and has never won.
Oh, my God.
He's the DiCaprio of cinematography. except it's way more egregious
that
he's lost. Like, 13 times. That's insane.
That's ridiculous. Yeah, and the shot they used of the soldiers walking in against the sunset. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It just made me really want to watch Sicario again.
Yeah, Sicario is a good movie. And Roger Deakins is a phenomenal cinematographer, so I'm hoping he wins, you know, one of these days soon.
Eventually.
Or it'll be like Ennio Morricone, and he won't win until he's, like, 87 years old.
That might have been one of the most touching moments of the...
I loved the fact that Morricone won. I mean, his Hateful Eight score is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And so that was great. But, yeah, like, him coming up and just, like, having to do the Italian translator thing.
Right.
I thought, it was great. And just
like a little Italian grandpa. He's so cool.
Yeah, he was great. He got, like, a standing ovation, too, I think, right?
Yeah. It was awesome. And I saw people upset that John Williams didn't win. But, like, come on.
Yeah, well, Morricone even recognized John Williams in his speech.
Yeah.
Which was nice, very classy. Like, two of the master cinematographers, like, or not cinematographers, composers.
Right.
Like, of the past, like, several decades of film.
Yeah. I like to imagine them just, like, hanging out playing, just, like, backgammon, just, like, doing old people things.
Right.
But with, like, amazing, epic movie music.
Yeah. Yeah, and John Williams was nominated. I think John Williams had 2 nominations, right? He was nominated for both Bridge of Spies and Star Wars.
Maybe
something like that. I think so. I mean, I actually met, like, John Williams has been nominated. I think this was his 50th nomination.
50 times? That's crazy.
And he's won 5 times.
Yeah,
which is great. Like, that's awesome. But I think Patton Oswalt's brother, tweeted out, like, a sad face and was like, John Williams lost the Oscar 45 times.
That's pretty good.
Pretty hilarious. And yeah, otherwise, I thought the whole ceremony was a lot of fun. Like, that's I think one of the best Oscar ceremonies that has happened in the last several years. I'm thinking of, like, last year Neil Patrick Harris hosted and it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Year before that was Ellen DeGeneres. It's fine. Seth MacFarlane hosted the year before that, and that's
right.
A pretty unpopular one, but I remember liking it a lot at the time. Maybe I'm just, like, a juvenile person.
Yeah, that's also very possible.
That's definitely possible. You know, and you know, Chris Rock has hosted once before, back in like 2004, I think. And he was, I remember really liking him then. I remember like him causing controversy then, for like dumb, like a really dumb reason, because he like insulted Jude Law in like his.
What?
It didn't even insult Jude Law. What I remember was this: he like made a joke about how Jude Law was starring in like every movie, because there was a year when Jude Law was just in a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
And he made a joke about how Jude Law was in a bunch of movies, and like that was it. Like that was basically it. And then like a little while later, Sean Penn came out to introduce an award. Uh-huh. And just said something along the lines of, like, I just want to make sure our host knows Jude Law is one of our finest working actors today. And, like, he was...
Of course Sean Penn did that.
Like, Sean Penn was really upset on the behalf of Jude Law. Like, oh no, somebody took Jude Law down a peg.
How dare they?
Yeah, but I thought, yeah, I thought Chris Rock was great here. He really, like, he really had some phenomenal jokes.
Yeah, And I was not worried, but I wasn't sure if he was going to do it. No one was sure he was going to do it. And then he made the whole show about diversity, and it was fucking awesome.
Yeah, it was great. And, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, like when Ricky Gervais hosts the Golden Globes, it's like presented as like a really edgy award show. And like, who knows what Ricky Gervais is going to say?
Yeah.
But like, I find it like really like, especially now, like these days, when now that like they're advertising it like that.
Right.
I find it kind of lame. Like, it's like, he's not really saying that much that's incendiary. But, like, Chris Rock actually had some, like, really edgy stuff.
Yeah, he did.
Like, stuff that I was, like, shocked to be hearing on the Oscar stage. And so,
that monologue was so awkward for everyone in that room. And it was awesome.
It was great. And, yeah, he was phenomenal. Also, Sarah Silverman, I did one point, was also great.
Yep.
Kind of, like, subtly insulting Sam Smith.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
It's pretty awesome. But, yeah. Otherwise, anything else about the Oscars, Mike, before you want to move on?
No, I think we've rambled on about the Oscars for a while.
Okay, yeah, we've talked about the Oscars until next year. Do you have any predictions for Oscars for 2016?
Mad Max Round 2. It's coming back.
Just, the movie's so goddamn good.
Just when you thought it was safe to be furious again.
Well, that seems like a tagline for a Fast and Furious movie, more than a Mad Max movie.
To drive the Fury Road again, I guess. Or to be Furiosa again? I don't know, like...
to Max, to Furiosa.
There it is. I would watch that.
I'd watch the hell out of that. although I imagine if Mad Max sequel happens, Furiosa probably won't be in it.
Yeah, and it'll be in 30 years when it comes out, so...
Well, I mean, I think... The idea is for it to happen relatively soon. I think George Miller was saying he wants to make like a smaller movie and then just make other Mad Max. And I think I think Warner Brothers will let him make a new Mad Max, like, and kind of just let him do his own thing.
What if he does a Babe 3?
That would be nuts. That would actually be phenomenal if he followed up Mad Max Fury Road with Babe 3.
There's probably already a Babe 3, but whatever.
Maybe there's.
It's probably like a direct-to-DVD thing.
You're probably right.
I don't know.
I have no idea.
But I would like to imagine them directing it the same way as Mad Max. Just like, no script, balls to the wall, just insanity.
Just remake Mad Max Fury Road with farm animals? Is that the idea?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Mad Max could be Babe. Babe would be Mad Max, right?
Oh, yeah.
His world is fire and pork. Furiosa could be, I don't know.
I don't know. It's been probably 20 years since I've seen Babe.
Yeah,
so.
I haven't seen Babe in a long time. I should watch it again. It's supposed to be. I probably saw it last when I was like 5, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So it'd be nice to see it again. I've heard it's great. I mean, I've seen it and I liked it a lot when I was 5, but yeah, all right.
Time changes a man.
All right, well... I know you've had that like a weird discussion. Let's move on to our featured review. This week we are reviewing Robert Eggers' The Witch.
What went we out into this wilderness to find? Leaving our country, kindred, our fathers' houses. For what? For the kingdom of God. Let us pray.
That was from the trailer for The Witch, the newest film written and directed by Robert Eggers. The film stars Anya Taylor-Joy, Ralph Ineson, Kate Dickey, both of whom, by the way, are from Game of Thrones. Kind of cool. Yeah. Harvey Scrimshaw, Ellie Granger, and Lucas Dawson. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, a family in 1630s New England is torn apart by the forces of witchcraft, black magic, and possession.
It's true.
Yeah. That is it, though.
IMDb, once again.
The one-sentence plot synopsis.
Nailed it.
Masters of their craft. So The Witch debuted at Sundance last year. It's a huge praise. Right, I don't know. Like, were you following a ton of critics at Sundance last year, Mike? Or no?
No, I was not.
Okay, well, I was. So I.
All right, tell us, what did they say, Mike?
Well, you know, it's just they've been like talking nonstop about this movie for like a year. They played at Sundance, did a huge response. Robert Eggers won the directing award at Sundance as well for this movie, and so it's something I've been very excited about for a while because I love horror movies, and you know, mm-hmm. anytime there's like one that like really gets critics excited, it's usually one that will get me excited too. And so in the past few years, like, you've seen like horror movies that have gotten like really big responses, like The Babadook or It Follows, The Guest would be another one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, The Witch seemed like the next in like that line of movies for me to be excited about. But even like in that realm of horror, like, I feel like it's a very unique kind of horror film.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Right. Like scares are like mostly built on like atmosphere and dread, but I feel like it's more than that. I feel like it's rare to see a movie set in this time period.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I was, so I've been doing the you know, don't watch trailers, you know, only what you see on TV and in the movies and stuff.
Right.
So I didn't really know anything. I saw one commercial for this movie.
Really?
Yeah. So I was like, I don't know what this is. Like, this is going to be cool, I guess. So going into it and it, treating the way it handles witchcraft and like all that stuff, I was not expecting at all. Which I don't know. I don't know if spoiler things. I don't know
right.
What to say. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
it was really unique and interesting in its choice to handle or how it handled that stuff.
Right. Absolutely. And we'll get to spoilers later on. Yeah. But yeah, and one of the things that does set this movie apart as well is that it's so committed to its time period's details,
right.
including language. And I think that's like kind of a big deal with this movie. Like there, are, like it uses a very like old style of dialects,
right?
Like, and it feels like, you know, it takes place in that time period, obviously. Mm-hmm. But there are times when the language used is like somewhat obtuse or hard to follow.
Somewhat.
But yeah. the thing is, it never like took me out of the scene. Like I was never like trying to figure out what they were saying,
right.
Because the context given, like from the performances and the direction, kind of gives you an idea of like what's going on.
Yeah, the words they're saying are not what's important. I don't think it's what is happening, what emotion is being used, and
exactly.
what's going on, which was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, in that way, like this movie is very reliant on performances, like it's actors, and every performance in this movie is terrific.
Yeah, even like the 4-year-old kids,
yeah,
or however old they're supposed to be.
The kids are amazing in this movie.
Oh my god!
Oh my god!
Yeah.
Eggers gets like he gets these really like naturalistic performances out of like these really young kids. And considering like the dialogue they have to say,
right? Yeah, the stuff how they're talking is outrageous.
Like I can't think of a single 5-year-old I know who could,
right?
You know,
me and you couldn't even do that.
Yeah, I could. You know, it's amazing that he was able to get that, like, make that happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, all the kids are great. But I think the one who really blows me away is the kid who plays Caleb. Which he has one scene that I'll talk about in spoilers that like. Mm-hmm. I was on the floor. Like, I was, yeah. I was
not gonna lie. I pulled the shirt up, was like, oh my god, oh my, like, for that scene. It was, yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Everyone, every performance is, beautiful and terrifying. Like, everything was really, just everything worked about this movie.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. And you know, I think, it's been an interesting movie to watch audiences react to.
Right. I was going to bring that up also.
Yeah. Did you have an audience in your theater?
Yeah, I texted you. I almost had a private viewing.
Okay.
I was the only one there, and then naturally, like, at the showtime, like, 10, 15 people showed up. Okay. I was like, oh, God damn it. But I think that it was better. Horror movies are always better with the audience in general, I think. But I had a different my audience had a different reaction than yours, I think.
Really? Did they, your audience mostly liked it?
Yeah, a couple people, when it ended, like, we stood up and I heard people being like, wow, that was really great, and like, yeah, talking to each other.
Man,
I know a lot of people hated it.
Yeah, my audience was not a fan, and I had a pretty sizable audience. Like, it wasn't huge, but like, a decent amount of people, and yeah, you could kind of just feel the energy in the room.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's a result. I just saw it yesterday as of recording this, and you saw it. It's been out for a week now, I believe.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's a result of, like, word of mouth. Now the people that a week later would...
That's possible.
...would know they would like it, would have seen it.
That's possible, yeah. I mean, again, this is a movie that is very different than most horror movies that come out.
Yeah,
and it's crazy that it's even got a wide release. Like, it's...
Yeah, yeah, which is awesome, just in itself.
And this is a movie distributed by A24, who also happened to make Ex Machina and Room, which were big at the Oscars last night.
There you go.
And yeah, this has turned into, I think, their biggest opening, I think, or something like that. Like,
wow.
Because most of their movies are released in very limited, are in very limited areas and very limited theaters. And so they really went all in with The Witch.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make a ton of money over the weekend, but over its first weekend anyway. But it made like way more than its budget was, because it got the wide release.
Right.
So. You know, it's encouraging. It's cool, and
And it's interesting how divisive the film is. Like, people, it either worked or was like terrible. Like,
yeah,
you know, for a lot of audiences,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and I feel like most audiences are not super into movies like The Witch that are very kind of slow paced, very methodical about what they're doing, and make more of a statement than necessarily do go for scares.
Right. Yes.
You know, I feel like a lot of horror movie audiences specifically, it's mostly not to like put down like horror movie audiences.
Yeah.
But like it's the kind of stuff that like dumb teenagers go to for like
it's the makeout movies.
It's the makeout movies, and like they mostly want jump scares. And like that's fine.
Yeah. That's good for them.
That's fine, whatever. And there's like great movies that are in that vein as well, but you know, it's The Witch is kind of something that is different, and it's, you know, disappointing to those people.
Yeah, I don't think there's any jumps, like, actual jump scares. Or there's probably a couple, but, like...
There's stuff that made me, like, squirm. I feel like I probably jumped at least once.
Yeah, but, like, that's true. I mean, in the more traditional, like...
Yeah, it's not stuff that's just jumping out at you for the sake of jumping out at you.
Right, that's what I meant. Yeah.
It's stuff that's, like, really, like... Like, it builds over time and, like, really, like...
Yeah.
Gets you going. But, yeah, so this movie is more about its message than it is about, like, just trying to scare you. I think it uses it to condemn religious fanaticism in a way that I found, like, really thrilling and engrossing.
Yeah. Yeah, it has this really bold choice to start at the end of a trial. Like, we start in the middle of whatever story is going on.
Right.
We're just cast out into the wilderness with this family.
Yeah. And again, it is difficult. Like, it kind of just throws you into it immediately. You don't, it's difficult to tell as the movie starts what is actually happening.
Right.
As it goes on, you get more acclimated to its kind of style of speaking and like its like way that it's made. But as like the trial's going on, I didn't really know ahead of time why they were cast out. As I was watching the movie, like, I didn't really get why they were cast out.
I don't think we are ever told specifically what happened.
I think you are. I think in the trial they do mention it, but it's so, like...
Oh, right, that's true.
But it is, like, the movie just started and they're speaking in, like, this, like, different dialect. But anyway, the reason they were cast out is because the father is, like... They basically, like, out-Puritan the Puritans. Like, they were so Puritan that, like, they were too much for that community. The father like looked down at everybody else like in the community for not being as pure as that like his family and everything like that.
Right. Yeah. They do mention that thing. Yeah. What I was going to say though, I think I had a conversation on Twitter with a friend of mine about she had seen the movie and it didn't work for her. She didn't like the he didn't, the atmosphere and like all that stuff didn't work. So I was like, let's talk about why and stuff. And she had a couple points. Was one that we never are told explicitly what had happened, that they were banished and stuff.
Right.
But I think the point isn't that they're banished or why they're banished. It's that he's so proud that he won't humble himself at all to stay. Like, he risks his whole family's life because he's so proud of himself for being pure.
Yep.
And time and time again throughout the film, we see the family is like, oh yeah, we're the most religious, pure, you know, they do the good thing. And then every time they are hypocrites and subvert themselves and let themselves down.
Yep.
And I think that's really the point of the film.
Yeah, you are correct. All right, I mean, is there anything else you want to bring up before we get into spoilers?
No, we could do... I guess just the direction and cinematography of this film really gets under your skin for me, at least.
No, it's very good. I think, like, this is Edgar's first movie, first feature-length film.
Feature-length, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's, like, I'm really excited to see where his career goes at this point.
There's the actor in the center of the frame, and, like, you're going to talk. And for it was just so... It's a thing you don't see very often, and when it happens, it feels odd, I guess. Like, it makes you feel weird, the fact that, like, there's nothing going on. You're just standing in the center of the frame having this really crazy dialogue, and I don't know. It worked for me.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was it's a very well-directed movie, and, it sounds like we're both really big fans of the movie.
Yeah.
I will say... Ralph Ineson and Kate Dickey, both of them were on Game of Thrones, but like I spent a lot of the movie I recognized both of them, but I had no idea from what. And then I looked them both up after the movie, and Kate Dickey, like, I saw Game of Thrones, I was like, oh yeah, Lisa,
I didn't recognize
Lisa Aaron,
right?
Like the Catelyn Stark's sister,
right?
Who had which I thought was kind of funny because she's had an inappropriate breastfeeding scene in both Game of Thrones.
I would say kind of oddly. Witch. Yeah, that's what I. Yes. Kind of oddly similar characters.
Yeah. And Ralph Ineson was also in Game of Thrones, but like I looked him up and I had no idea who his character was in Game of Thrones. Like he's some recurring season 2 character. But he also happens to be in like half of the things I've seen in my entire life. like he was in Harry Potter also.
Yep.
And a bunch of other stuff. I don't have his thing up there like on my thing, but he's like anything that's British, he's
been in a ton of stuff. And they both give like powerhouse performances in this film.
Yeah, they're both incredible. And the lead of the movie, Anya Taylor-Joy,
oh my god,
Tess Thompson, fantastic. Like she's awesome. I thought like the movie started and I thought like she looks like way too pretty to like be like this Puritan family character in like 1630s, right. But you know, she's awesome anyway. Like, she's...
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't notice until I was having the discussion on Twitter that Sin is literally in her name. Thomas Sin.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So, that was cool. That's a cool little thing.
There.
Yeah. To, like, I typed it out and was like, wait a second.
All right, let's move into spoilers, right? Can we do this?
Yes.
All right,
yes.
Let's move into spoilers for The Witch, starting right now. All right, so spoilers for The Witch, starting right now. So at the ending of this movie is, like, batshit insane.
Yeah, I didn't expect the very last scene to happen.
Yeah, there was a point where I thought the movie had ended.
Twice. It happened to be twice.
It happened twice? Okay, I think I definitely know at least one of those, part. And then it kept going, and the final, like, scene of it is really incredible and kind of, like, puts the entire movie into perspective, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Thomason joins Black Phillip and becomes a witch.
Right.
And kind of, like, rejects, or I should backtrack, I guess.
Yeah. Explain who Black Phillip is.
Right, so Black Phillip is this goat that
they
have at the family farm, and he was like, it's always around. Like, they keep mentioning Black Phillip.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out Black Phillip is the devil.
Yeah, Yeah, which my friend Laura pointed out to me. What was one of the things that griped her was if the family was so superstitious and religious, they would recognize the black goat as a symbol of the devil. Like, that's a pretty obvious, like, that's what that is. Like, that's a very common and always has been, like, a black goat or, you know. Hmm. And they, like, probably would have killed it and not kept it. But I think that that feeds into the, like, another example of how hypocritical and not actually religious the family is. Except I think the only one who actually believes everything is the mother. And even she falls into temptation.
I feel like the father is very, very religious, like, very puritanical.
Right. Well, I meant, like, actually... not a hypocrite, because he allows the son to lie. He is so proud he banishes his whole family to be.
Okay.
And I feel like the mother actually believes everything until she's tempted. She falls to temptation of having her dead children come back.
Right.
But that was super creepy. Like, the kids chasing Black Phillip and Black Phillip talking to them. They keep saying Black Phillip talks to them.
Right.
And, like, all of those things. Turns out he actually is the devil.
Yeah. Anyway, so as the movie ends, Thomason, after her whole family has either been killed or disappeared.
Yes.
After this huge struggle with her mother as well, she had to kill her own mother who was trying to kill her. You know, she, like, kind of goes into the shack, starts, like, crying.
Yeah.
And the movie, like, cuts to black. And that's where I thought it was going to end. And I was like, wow, that's a very good moment to end on.
But right.
It seemed like a final shot. And then it kind of started up again and kept going, and she was led to Black Phillip's, like, kind of lair.
Right. Yeah. Right?
And she joins Black Phillip and becomes a witch. And
yeah, she joins the coven.
Joins a coven and, like, sheds all of her clothes, rises, and starts, like, floating, rising above, yeah. And starts laughing. And then the movie ends.
Yeah. Yeah, well, where I thought it was going to end was maybe when after she kills her mother and... falls asleep at the table. Like, that seemed like a really, like, anti-climax kind of thing to end.
That's what I'm talking about. That's when I thought it was going to end.
Oh, okay. And then when she walks off into the woods with Black Phillip, it cuts to black before it cuts to the coven.
Okay.
So I thought it was just going to, like, yeah, she joined Black Phillip, and we don't see it. We weren't going to see the whole coven thing. But that was a really interesting, odd... She is so happy in the... Thomason is so happy in that moment when she starts flying... And it's like a weird, like, backwards woman's liberation thing. Like, she shed society, she right. shed her clothes, but, like, she serves the devil now? Like, I don't... It's really odd.
I mean, it's a very, like, complex message, I think. It's very...
Yeah.
Because I think, like, this movie's actually been embraced by, like, Satanists.
Who, it has, yes.
Who kind of praise it for, like, endorsing Satanism and other, like, unholy acts. I don't think the movie is necessarily, like, endorsing Satanism.
No. Well, and the Church of Satanism is a joke.
Well, it's, yeah, that too.
they use that to express, like, common sense liberal ideals, and it's great. But it's a really weird thing for, like, the film to have Satan be her salvation in the end.
Exactly,
although,
yeah.
It is not her salvation. I don't know.
I think, you know, what it is, it's like, this movie is trying to make the point that, like, this religious fanaticism is kind of what drove this family insane.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And it's, like, this repression of, like, the things that make them human. I think sexuality specifically is a huge factor.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Is kind of what causes all of this to happen in the movie. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, like I said before, like, they out-Puritan the Puritans. Like, this family is,
right.
like, intense. And I think the film doesn't really have a problem with religion, like, necessarily, but it has a problem right. with denying, like, human behaviors.
Yeah, with, like, fundamentalism, I guess.
Yeah, and so it's... Yeah, I think it would be more fundamentalist, if anything else, than Satanist.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, every time the father has Caleb, like, repeat his stuff, it's, you know, I'm born of sin. We have inherent evil in us all the time.
Right.
And you couldn't possibly live your life that way.
Yeah, like, that's insane.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nuts. And, there were people that did
yeah,
that.
It happened.
Still are.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, it's intense, and it's, you know, it's an intense message, and I think it's a very complex ending to make that message, to make that statement.
Right. Yeah, but, I guess now that since we've talked about it, what I didn't know... going in was like that it was about an actual witch. I just kind of assumed it was like a witch hunt horror movie type thing.
Right. Yeah. I didn't really know that much about the movie going in. I had seen the trailer, but had not like researched any story specifics. I did not think the movie would actually have a witch in it.
Right.
I assumed it would kind of be like the Salem Witch Trials or something where there would be.
Right. That's what I thought it was. Yeah. But then the first, Samuel, the infant goes missing. And then we cut to a literal witch in her hovel, turning him into goo to, like, enchant her wand or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit, this is, like, real. This is happening.
Right. But even then, I feel like the movie pretty definitively states that witches are real in that universe. But
yeah.
But even then, I feel like you don't get, like, a definitive view on that until the very end of the movie when she joins the coven.
Right, that's true.
Which, like, it keeps you, like, wondering what's happening. Like, you definitely understand that something supernatural is going on. There would have to be.
Right.
Everything, like, the witch that you see in that scene is, like, obscured. Like, you don't really see her face.
Right.
It's a very dark scene. And mm-hmm. later on, Caleb's in the woods and is kind of, like, led by this other witch, right?
Right.
She doesn't say anything. You don't really know what's going on. You're just kind of taken in by this imagery, and like right. It's implied that it's a witch, but it's not like outright stated.
That's true. Yeah, but well, what I was going to say, it's like an odd juxtaposition because the family life on the farm, seemingly I don't know, seemed so well researched and so like historically accurate,
right?
Like even down to the dialogue, like we've been talking about. And then yet there is this supernatural religious force that is equally as real as the farm life in this film. And I think, and then I remembered about halfway through the title card comes up, The Witch, a New England folktale.
Right.
And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. It's a folktale. These kinds of things in folktales, this is all 100% real. This is what this
that's
is.
True. Like, yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting way to go about doing this is like set it in a folktale to have this be, yeah, religion, God, witches, magic, all that stuff is like 100% possible and real.
Yeah.
So yeah. I enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, the scene that I wanted to talk about before, about Caleb's scene,
mm-hmm.
That blew me away, his death scene.
Oh my God.
Unreal. Like that actor, I forget his name. What was it?
What is he like? 14?
Yeah, Harvey Scrimshaw as Caleb. In that scene, like, blew me away. I could not believe what I was watching during that scene because he's like basically possessed, but like
right. He's been witched.
He's been witched, and it's this whole thing. He like coughs up a bloody apple,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's like gross and intense.
Yeah.
Then like just the way he starts talking and the way his body starts moving and like the way he's like expressing his love of God right before dying.
Yeah,
it's. It is insane, and like I could not believe like the scene that I watched. It was like I've only seen a few movies from 2016 so far
because
It's only February. But
right.
That is the best scene out of any movie I've seen so far this year, and like I feel like it's gonna be up there as like best scenes of the year. Like that's up there for like
that scene the apple, nice homage to fairy tale type things. but yeah, that is like. Gorgeous. Everything. The window behind him, and he's, like, super pale and, like, glowing as he's professing his love for Jesus and God's open arms. And it's, like, a really long, extended, like, one-take monologue, too.
Yeah. All done in one, like, take.
And he's writhing all over the place, and it's crazy.
Man.
And then he dies, and it was freaking crazy. I don't know.
Nuts. I Harvey Scrimshaw was amazing in that. Like,
yeah.
Like, and, I really hope he's in, like, a shitload more stuff.
Yeah, and I hope they're all set in 1630 Massachusetts. Yeah, but like we said too, all of the kids and all five of them or whatever, everyone in the film, the family, they all give an amazing powerhouse performance.
Yes, yeah, no, they're all incredible, and yeah, this movie I think is heavily reliant on the strength of its actors, but like it's very well directed and well composed and shot and everything like that as well.
Yeah,
it's very well. Like paced and tense, throughout.
Yeah.
And so
There's a lot of kind of toying with like traditional horror movie devices, I guess, like the crescendoing violins with the creepy like plucking and all that stuff. But like, it's just over a shot of the forest, like nothing's happening, and like it just gets under your skin and messes with you to expect something to happen, and then it just cuts to black, and then like another scene starts, and nothing even happened.
Right.
And it's great. I really dove into the like spooky folktale mindset. Like, that really got me for this film, to just believe in this world. Once I like remembered the folktale thing in the title card, was like, oh yeah, like this is how these things, like these worlds operate like this. That like, of course the forest would be the scariest thing possible to this family.
Right.
Like, they've been banished from they came to a new world. They've been banished to the wilderness by themselves.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And that really got me, which I don't know. I wonder if, that's a product of us being in the Northeast and like this kind of thing being part of our, like social consciousness in some weird way.
That's
like
true.
Sleepy Hollow's near around here.
Yeah,
Salem's not far. Like this kind of witchcraft, black magic story is sort of local.
Kind of like, yeah. It's not something that like has always been in my mind, but it's something that I've known about and like,
right.
It is nearby.
Yeah. It's not something I think about a lot, but like in context of this film, I was like, yeah, like this kind of hits home in a weird way.
Okay.
So I wonder, I mean, I know every region has their own version of those stories, but
right.
And this one was about ours. So that's cool.
Very cool. Yeah. Anyway, so do you have any final thoughts about The Witch, Mike, before we finish up?
I liked it a lot, obviously. I feel like this is a type of movie that I could see myself, like, thinking back to often. Like, just, I don't know.
Yeah,
it has a lot going on. Like, there's a lot of layers happening, I think,
yeah,
with whatever message is being said.
Yeah, and I saw it a week ago, and you just saw it yesterday. But, yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot since I saw it, so... Definitely one of those kind of movies, yeah. And
it's even interesting when I was talking with my friend Laura... that even though she didn't like the movie, like, we still had a lot to discuss. And even if the scariness isn't, like, doesn't work for you, it still is really interesting and has a lot for discussion. So that, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool.
Definitely, definitely. All right. So, yeah, both big fans of The Witch. Definitely see it if you can.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Really good work. All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as all my podcasts at filmbook.com, including Agent Carter podcast, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Gotham. And you can find our other podcast, The Complete Works, at filmbook.com as well. Thank you for listening to Filmbookcast. If you're listening to our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We use so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next week for a new episode of The Complete Works, in which Mike and I will be discussing Nicolas Cage's role in the 1990 Top Gun ripoff, Firebirds.
Oh, it's going to be so good.
Oh, man. I am excited for it and dreading it at the same time. And you can join us in 2 weeks, where we'll probably be reviewing a totally rad production.
Hey,
right?
Nice.
10 Cloverfield Lane. I can't. It's out. It's coming out in 2 weeks.
I know.
It's awesome. That's crazy. Like,
we
just found out that movie existed like 6 weeks ago.
That's the best. I wish more movies would do that.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm really excited. And like Dan Trachtenberg, man.
Yeah.
Like, he used to be on the Totally Rad Show. He used to be one of us.
He was. Now he's making movies with J.J. Abrams.
Making J.J. Abrams movies. He's got commercials going on at the Super Bowl and during the Oscars. Like,
crazy.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
He's an inspiration to us all.
Could happen to you too, Mike.
Good. You never know.
Podcasts can launch you into stardom.
That is the plan. That's why we're doing this. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.
As coroner, I must have her. I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead. is a day of independence for all the Munchkins and their descendants. If any, yes, let the joyous news be spread. The wicked old